It's really interesting to see how these companies are approaching Chicago, right?
She was telling me she's really trying to understand how the tech ecosystem here works.
What's interesting about the baby boomers is that they've never met a debt they didn't like.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
7:20 and good afternoon, everyone. A happy New Year's Eve to you. Gorgeous day in the Chicagoland area. Just makes you want to sit inside. I think that's what a lot of people are doing today. Steve Bertrand is out. My name is John Hansen. I'll be filling in this week here. No business lunch tomorrow, but then we'll pick it back up again on Wednesday. Today, we got a packed show. We're going to start things off with our good friend Jim Dahlke over the senior editor at Chicago. You know, Jim, thanks for joining us here on this last day of the year.
Hey, John, thanks for having me. Happy New Year's Eve.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's jump into some of these stories because they really, you got a real interesting bunch of stories for us today. And talking about wearable technology, this is something we've been talking about the last few years, developed by researchers right here at Northwestern University. Front and center in a new commercial, right?
Yeah, that's right. So new wearable technology from some folks at Northwestern is a very visible part of a new ad campaign by Gatorade. So you may have seen a new ad running on TV right now called You Fuel Us, We Fuel You. And it features Serena Williams wearing a wearable patch that was actually designed by researchers here at Northwestern University.
And what does the patch do?
Yeah, so it's a lot different than, you know, what you might be used to seeing with the Apple Watch or the Fitbit. This is as thin as a temporary tattoo, and it attaches directly to your skin. And so basically, the idea of the patch is that it measures electrolyte loss. So it knows in real time how you're losing and how much electrolytes you're losing, and it transmits that directly to a cell phone. So Serena Williams, a big part of this commercial, and you can see her kind of wearing the patch later on in the ad itself. And so really interesting to see how kind of local tech is sort of making a very visible sort of national landscape here.
All right, so that's great that Serena knows when her electrolytes are down. I can't imagine myself or most of our listeners really caring if their electrolytes had gone down a little bit. But is this technology, do we foresee it being a bigger impact for the general public moving forward?
I think so. So basically right now it kind of has a very sort of niche use case, right? Like very competitive athletes. So that's kind of where I think it's sort of starting right now. But it has a lot of use cases, I think, going forward. They say that it also can provide non-intrusive screening for certain diseases. You can imagine, you know, using that for certain folks who might be susceptible to different diseases. And then they say, you know, in the future they hope that this could actually go from on top of your skin to inside your body and actually fix things like an irregular heartbeat. So really kind of moonshot things that Northwestern is really tackling here, and it's very, very interesting to kind of see how the whole wearable industry sort of evolves beyond tracking your steps, right? So that's kind of the biggest thing right now that your Apple Watch and your Fitbit can do. But really what we're talking about here at Northwestern is really, really going the next step with wearable tech.
And I remember when people freaked out about a fingerprint opening up their phone. But moving on to another story, obviously one of the big stories of 2018 was HQ2. Chicago did not end up with the second headquarters for Amazon, but you still have some good news for Chicago and still a destination place for a lot of tech companies.
Yeah, you know, everybody, I think, or not everybody, but lots of folks were sort of disappointed that Chicago missed out on Amazon HQ2, but Chicago really does remain a very popular destination for a lot of these coastal tech companies to expand their operations. So CBRE just put out a recent kind of end-of-year report, kind of taking a look at office expansion and sort of tech real estate. And Chicago was actually the second most popular destination for companies based in the Bay Area, Seattle, Boston, and New York to open new office space. They were only behind Amazon in total number of square footage for tech office relocation. So Chicago's still very much a popular destination. You know, Chicago being the size that it is, you would expect it to do well, obviously, but it still was able to kind of outpace cities like Los Angeles, like Washington, D.C., like Denver, and you know, it's a trend that we're seeing basically, you know, over the last several years. Google has made lots of real estate investment in the Chicago area. Facebook has done the same. There's even beyond that, you know, you're seeing companies like Pinterest and even Snapchat has a small office in Chicago. So what's interesting, too, beyond this is that, you know, Chicago has long been the destination for sales offices. So everybody would kind of come to Chicago when they're ready to open a sort of big Midwest sales operation. But what we're seeing now is that really Chicago has been a destination for engineering, so real hard tech jobs, are right here in Chicago. So no longer just a sales outpost here in Chicago. The Windy City is really becoming a place for kind of high-tech roles in a lot of these West Coast and East Coast tech companies.
Jim Dahlke, the senior editor of Chicago Inno, don't go anywhere. He's going to tell us after a quick break about a company known very well to Chicago area folks, is trying out some new things with some startups. We'll have that in just a moment. Happy New Year's Eve, everyone. John Hansen in for Steve Bertrand on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hey, I want to hear from you, 312-981-7200. Would love for you to text in your business New Year's resolutions, what you want to do in 2019 with your personal finances, any goals you have with your business. Love to hear from yours. I want to save more chicken money, as Terry Savage likes to call it. Bought a place this year, wiped out all my savings for a down payment. Love to build that up just a little bit. Hey, one of your goals this year should be to read Chicago Inno a little bit more. We got Jim Dahlke, senior editor, on the line, right? That should be everyone's goal, right, Jim?
Yeah, check us out, ChicagoInno.com, and then sign up for our daily newsletter, which is The Beat, which is kind of like this conversation we're having right now, but sort of every day in your email inbox.
All right, so CES, am I saying that right? That's every year there's this giant showcase of new tech stuff. Does it have any special name to it, or just CES 2019?
Yeah, so CES originally named the Consumer Electronics Show,
so they
kind of rebranded to the CES name. But so really CES is, you know, for years has been kind of one of the most closely watched tech events of the year, and really kind of sets the tone for tech trends throughout the year. So coming up later in January down in Las Vegas, about 4,000 companies will kind of show their latest trends in tech.
And a couple Chicago companies to watch. You've got a full list on your website of 12 Chicago companies to watch. What's your favorite one, or what's a really interesting one you want to share with the listeners?
You know, I really like this this company called Petronix. And basically what they do is they create robots for pets. It sounds really silly,
right?
But their kind of flagship product is called Mouser. And it is essentially an artificially intelligent mouse robot for your cat. So basically what it does is it kind of learns your cat's movements and will basically keep it running in circles by navigating around your apartment or your house and basically keeping your cat active and really learning its movements and changing its movements based on how your cat's acting. So kind of a silly little piece of technology, but one that has been developed down in Champaign, and one that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, shout out to Champaign for that. You know, I think a lot of people listen and say, oh, well, for gosh sake, just play with your cat. But, you know, you're gone a few hours a day, a couple hours a day at work. What a great thing to keep you active all year, all day long.
Exactly, yeah, and especially, you know, if you're having issues with, you know, maybe the cat's tearing up your couch or something,
right,
maybe keeping it a little more active will keep it a little bit better behaved.
I love that. Okay, so a company that, you know, you went, at least maybe this is unfair to think of it like this, but when I hear John Deere, I think of, you know, old school company, big industrial stuff. I don't think startup, and maybe that's the wrong thing, but John Deere really trying to build these tractors of the future, and they're really developing relationships with startups to help them reach new customers moving forward.
That's totally fair. When you think tech and innovation, tractors are not the first thing that comes to mind for a lot of people. But John Deere has really been doing a lot of interesting things of late in terms of being more tech forward. They have an intelligent solutions group, which is kind of all about AI and machine learning and all kinds of new advancements in technology and robotics. And basically within that group, they've created a new program to kind of foster better relationships with startups, and it's called the Startup Collaborator Program. Basically what this means is John Deere just wants to get to know startups better, and they want to connect with companies that they might be able to work with to help out Deere's customers. So the interesting thing kind of about this relationship is it's not as formal as an incubator program or even, you know, like a tech investment. So this is kind of pretty, this is flexible in the sense of, hey, we want to get to know what your tech is about. We want to offer you mentorship from a Fortune 500 company and potentially develop a relationship where maybe there's an investment down the road, or maybe they buy this technology to use in different parts of their company. So interesting to see how John Deere is really making some very significant moves to get closer to startup companies, and they're already working with a handful of upstarts right now as we speak.
Got about 30 seconds left, but I love the Mom Project, a startup that's really designed to help moms or people that have left the workforce, plenty of women in that category as well, you know, for voluntary or for other reasons as well, trying to re-enter the workforce. That isn't always the easiest thing to do, and the Mom Project's trying to help out. They got a big fundraising startup money going.
Yeah, the Mom Project just raised $8 million earlier this month, and they have a terrific business idea, right? They want to help women who've kind of left the workforce maybe to kind of focus on the home, focus on raising a kid, and now they're ready to jump back into the workforce. And they really specifically focus on helping women connect with companies and get back into the workforce. So they've raised about $11 million to date, and they have 70,000 women kind of in its network who have worked through the platform to land jobs, and they work with more than 1,000 employers. So companies including BP, AT&T, and Netflix, kind of helping women land these roles back getting into the workforce. So really, really interesting Chicago startup and a platform that's really taking off kind of across the country.
Jim Dulkey, remind people where they can find these and plenty other stories.
Yeah, check us out at chicagoinno.com, and there you can sign up for our daily newsletter, The Beat.
Jim, have a great start to the new year, okay?
You too, John. Thanks.
WGN, happy New Year's Eve to you out there on this Monday afternoon. A dreary one at that for 2018. Saved its best weather for last here the last few days. John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand. I'll be here all week. No business lunch tomorrow, though. We'll be closed just like the markets are. Okay, so U.S. population does continue to grow. I guess that's the good news. But it is growing at its slowest rate since 1937. Here to break down perhaps why and what that's all about is Bill Frey. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute Metropolitan Policy Program. Bill, thanks for joining us here this afternoon.
Oh, it's good to be with you, John.
And, you know, this is a pretty shocking number. I mean, we've seen a general decline of the population growth rate, but this marks the lowest rate ever. We had a little rebound in 2015, it looks like, but, man, this is a real low number.
Yeah, I mean, this is as low as it's been since 1937, just, you know, in the wake of the Great Depression.
Yeah, right.
So it's what's really causing this, it's down to 0.62%. We're inching down to about a half percent growth compared to maybe 2% in the 1950s when we were making all these babies in the United States. But I think babies are part of this. You know, we have what's known in the trade of demography as a decline in natural increase. That's the excess of births over deaths. And what's been happening the last few years, we've been getting fewer births and more deaths. And as a result, that population growth is going down.
You know, you look at Japan, another country that has seen much steeper, they're actually losing population at this point. I guess when I look at 0.62%, and we're going to talk more about why that might be the case moving forward, but do you guys project at all where this is going? Is this going to continue to decline? Is it possible in the next decade or two decades we're going to start to see actual decreasing populations?
Well, the Census Bureau's projections go out to 2060. Over that period, we're not going to have a decline in population, but we're going to have much lower natural increase than we have now because we're an aging population. And between now and 2030, the next 12 years, I guess 11 years starting tomorrow, the 65 and over population, the older population, people my age, right, will be increasing by 40%. And so what happens when you get more people in those older years, then eventually they're going to be moving into their 70s and their 80s, and that's going to increase the number of deaths. The number of births are not going to be nearly as much to catch up with that. Fortunately, in our projections and the Census Bureau's projections, we continue to have an immigration of about 1 million a year. We've had that fairly steadily. It's gone down a little bit during the Great Recession. And over time, that's going to be the bigger part of our population growth nationally, not births, but immigration.
Yeah, it's interesting that obviously immigration is a hot policy, has been for the past few years. And I know there's a lot of debates on both sides of the aisle about immigration. We don't have to get into anything like that. But without immigration, I mean, really, we would be in danger of losing population in the next 20 or 30 years.
We're getting close to it. I mean, yeah. I think even without immigration, there'd be a tiny population increase, but it would be stagnant. And where we're really going to show declines, absolute declines in our population, will be among the younger part of the population. Already we have a decline in the population under age 18. That's the case nationally and in 29 states. So to the extent we're growing at all, it's more in the adult population and especially in that senior population.
Do you guys dive into maybe the psychology behind it? I'm an older millennial. A lot of my friends getting married later than perhaps my parents' generation did, having kids later, which simply, if you just look at the numbers, if you start having kids a little bit later, odds are maybe each person, not this isn't across the board, but maybe each family has one less than they would have maybe 20 or 30 years ago. Is it just simple stuff like that, or are there more complicated answers in there?
Well, I think that's a little bit part of it, and I would say that this bigger decline that we had in the last couple of years may be a little bit of a fluke, maybe a jumping ahead a little bit because of the millennials sort of putting off having marriage, having kids, buying homes, all of this sort of thing. It may be that that fertility rate may go up just a tad, maybe within the post-millennial generation that may have not had the economic, problems that the millennials have had. But we're not going to, in the long term, see any major increases in fertility. And it has a lot to do with the age structure. You have proportionately fewer women in the childbearing ages as the overall population ages. And so even if they have about the same number of kids as they have now, the fact that there are going to be fewer of them going ahead, that means the number of births go down. But as you say, it may be that future generations continue to put off, you know, having kids until their late 20s or 30s, and that also will contribute to the lower fertility and the aging of the population going forward.
That's interesting that you look 10 years past the Great Recession and we're still seeing the effects of that. That makes sense. People getting out of college, perhaps, or in their first few years working, maybe a lot of them lost their gigs. Right in 2008, you're not going to go out and, unless a lot of people aren't going to go out and have kids during that time. Do you see that fluctuation throughout time with terms of economic downturns? I mean, you mentioned this is the lowest population growth since 1937, which was still in the middle of the Great Depression, of course. Is that something that is consistent over time, economic boons and slowdowns affecting population a few years after the fact?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that the fact that these younger people now, I guess millennials are now up to age 38.
I know.
but, you know, even some post-millennials are going to see their older brothers and sisters, and they're going to say, you know, I saw what happened when they lost their home during foreclosure, or they're not able to get a job and so forth. I'm going to be a little more cautious going forward before I make that plunge.
One fascinating thing you guys also looked at was geographic mobility at a very low rate as well, which is really counter to what I anecdotally experience in my group of friends and extension of my group of friends. I feel like maybe it's just an Illinois, Chicago, Illinois thing. A lot of my friends are, and they're millennials too, older millennials moving to the West Coast, moving to Denver. But the statistics bear that's a vast minority of people.
Well, yes. I mean, typically, young people in the 20s and early 30s have the highest level of migration, and that's still the case. Mm-hmm. But the overall level of migration among them and everybody else has gone down a tad in the last several years. Some of it has to do with the housing market, because a big part of movement across the U.S. is local movement. And so that drives the overall mobility rate. And we have really the lowest level of local movement, people moving within the same county, since the end of World War II, when they started putting these statistics together. And I chalk that up to the very, very slowly creeping back housing market. Now we know that mortgage rates are going up a little bit again. So again, a little bit of caution on the part of these young people, still kind of stuck. I don't know if they're all living in their parents' basements anymore, and maybe your friends are different than most of them, but I think some of that is still going on.
Bill, with your work at the Brookings Institute, obviously you're crunching all these numbers. Do you guys kind of go to that next step and say, well, here's the problems with the tax burden being perhaps an inverted pyramid, Social Security? I mean, this has implications moving forward for a lot of folks that are looking to hopefully have that little nest egg when they retire in the coming years.
Well, I do think we have to plan on having an aging population, whatever that means.
Right.
And there are lots of people on both sides of the aisle have solutions, or at least some proper solutions in how we're going to deal with that. But, you know, as we see more people going into their 60s and 70s and 80s, I don't know if you and your friends have parents in that situation and maybe wondering about what they're going to do with if they have real health problems. And, you know, my feeling is somebody's going to have to do that. And it's I think eventually is going to be the government's going to have to spend a little more effort on that. What that means then in terms of our retirement system, should people wait later until they retire? Should people, we give people more incentives to put money away for those elderly years, make that more attractive to do that for folks? That's people beyond my pay grade trying to figure that one out. But it's really coming, and I think that's a real issue that we're going to have to deal with.
Bill, I was hoping you'd tell me exactly how much I'm going to get in Social Security in 35 years, but it sounds like you're not going to tell me that.
No, that's not going to happen.
Bill Fry, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute Metropolitan Policy Program. Have a good new year, Bill, okay?
You too.
Plenty more coming up on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. This year was particularly interesting for brick-and-mortar retail, and Sears was without a doubt the poster child in the worst way possible. The Illinois-based retailer has gotten even smaller after they announced they'll be closing 80 Sears and Kmart locations across the country by March. They now own little more than 400 stores around the country. Since October, they've had to close nearly 260 stores. The very teensy-teensy itty-bitty light at the end of the tunnel is still there, that being the bid from the hedge fund ESL Investments, but it's not looking too great. That's a tough pill to swallow. And don't look now, because Gap is also closing a handful of Chicago area stores. Three Gap locations at Fox Valley Mall in Aurora, Town Square in Wheaton, and Hawthorne Mall are closing their doors due to poor performance. And it's a peek into the bigger picture, since kicking off 2019, Gap will also plan to close their New York flagship office sometime next year. Oof, I guess you can only go up from here, right? I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
720 WGN, the Wintrust Business Lunch. John Hansen here in for Steve Bertrand. Hey, coming up, the stories that matter from David Jennings in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Got John Williams in 1 to 3, and I just saw Brian Noonan stroll in with his Blackhawk sweater. He'll be coming in, I believe, in at 3 o'clock for Row. You know, we talk about the most admired men and women, the lists that come out towards the end of the year. They come out by Gallup. They do these polls, and they're always fascinating to see what the newest trends are, or maybe some trends that have been there for a long time. And here to break that down for us is Lydia Sant, the Director of U.S. Social Research at Gallup. And Lydia, thanks for joining us here on New Year's Eve.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So the big story, a couple different things. Hillary Clinton, who's been the most admired woman for some time, dropping from the top spot. Michelle Obama taking her place. It was really quite a run for Secretary Clinton.
Yeah, that's sort of the big news this year. Hillary Clinton's been number one on this list for 17 years, and that spans, you know, every permutation of her career, from first lady to senator, secretary of state, presidential candidate. And so this year, with her having none of those monikers, she dropped down to number three. Still in the top 10, which is, you know, a rare place to be, but not number one anymore.
So when you look at most admired man, it's unusual to not have the sitting president at number one. The former president takes the top spot, President Obama leading President Trump. And, you know, when you break down who says what, it's absolutely no surprise, of course, the splits from political demographics. And I guess that leads me to this question. Is it always politicians that are at the top of these lists, Lydia?
Either politicians or religious leaders. So pretty much the times that a president doesn't make the top, you've got someone like Pope Francis, not Francis, but a pope or a religious leader at the top. Billy Graham has been a popular person over the years, but almost always a sitting president.
It's only been a few times that it hasn't been, in fact, right?
That's correct. It's almost always the sitting president. So certainly Barack Obama, all 8 years of his presidency, and even his president-elect year, he bumped George W. Bush off the rung in 2008. So Trump is the first president since Ford who so far during his presidency has not been number one.
Lydia, I got to ask, because when you add up the numbers, obviously, when we're talking about most admired woman and man, especially in this year, we're certainly not talking about a majority of people picking Michelle Obama or a majority of people picking Barack Obama. It's a plurality. And I guess I'm just surprised, I guess, how low these numbers are. And when you add up the top 11 that I'm looking at here at Gallup.com, you're really not even still getting to over 50% of the total number. So what does everyone else say? Is it just a smattering of answers? Can people say, like, my mom, my dad? Do we get answers like that, too?
We do. We get, you know, maybe about 1 in 10 saying a friend or a relative for most admired man, and a little bit more than that for woman. But, yeah, so we get a smattering of that. Then we just get a smattering, basically. That's the word. Mm-hmm. We get a whole bunch naming people that don't even make the list with 1% or even 0.5%. And then we get about a quarter who just can't think of anybody. But you're right. These are relatively small percents. You know, Obama this year is named number one with 19%, and Michelle Obama with 15%. So this is what we call a top of mind response. We're getting people on the phone. They have to come up with a name quickly. And what's remarkable to me is, even though these numbers are small, that the rank order is very similar, as we talked about, in type every year after year. The people think of most often for man is the president. For woman, it's first lady or another prominent entertainment or political figure usually. So the same kinds of people bubble up, but the absolute percentages are pretty low.
Let's give a shout out to Queen Elizabeth. Come on, 50th time. That's impressive.
50 years. I know. I wonder if she read this article. I'm kind of wondering now.
I don't know, Lydia. Lydia Asada, Director of U.S. Social Research at Gallup. Thanks for your time, and have a happy new year, okay?
All right. Thanks so much.